You know, the question about believing propaganda is a really important question. And not all of it is religious. That's some of the most significant parts. You know, the example Mimi was just talking about for Catholics is one aspect. For Christian Zionists who define themselves that way, who tend to be Protestants, not only, but mostly are Protestant, it's a very specific set of understandings of what God requires, mm-hmm. right? And it's a pretty creepy thing, actually, if you look at the theological basis of it. It's not just that Christians who support Israel. There's plenty of Christians who support Israel. That, you know, it's their right to support Israel. But Christian Zionism specifically has a very specific religious connotation, which as a Jew is kind of distressing, because at the end of the day, you either convert or die. And, you know, that's not such a fun choice to have. But it's based on the notion, it's not just support for the State of Israel, it's support for the Zionist project of what they call ingathering of the Jewish people, meaning that all Jews everywhere in the world should go to Palestine, because until that happens, the Second Coming can't occur. And if you believe in the Second Coming of Christ, which plenty of people do, of course, that can't happen until the Jews are gathered in Israel, which would be an okay thing to imagine. You know, it's not the worst thing in the world. But step two is once they are all gathered in what is now Israel or in Palestine, they either convert or die. That's sort of what has to happen before Christ can come back. And I remember thinking when I learned about this, it's like, wait a minute. These are all these people saying they support Israel, what calls itself the Jewish state, and they want all the Jews to convert or die? You know, what kind of support is that? And how is it that Israeli officials are so willing to make common cause with these guys, right? And the Israeli answer is a very practical one. Israelis tend to be very practical people, actually. Their line is, we know that's nonsense. We will take our friends wherever we get them and be done with it. You know, they're willing to put money into our causes. They're willing to mobilize for the support of Israel. What's not to like? If they want to believe that at the end of the day, Jews are going to have to either convert or die, that's their business. We don't believe it. We don't care what they think. So it's thoroughly anti-Semitic and thoroughly insulting, actually, to the Christian Zionist allies of Israel, because they don't take their religious part seriously. Mm-hmm. But the other, that's not the only kind of propaganda that we're dealing with, right? There's also the whole question of what does it mean for Jews in this country to grow up thinking that being Jewish is wrapped up with Israel? When I was a kid growing up here in Culver City, we didn't really have the choice of defining a variety of identities if we identified as Jewish. If you identified as Jewish, you identified with Israel. Period, full stop. That's what there was, right? And it's a very generational thing. Because what we see now, what's so extraordinary, is young Jews all over the country, around the world as well, but it's particularly visible here in the United States, growing up to say, you know what, my identity is not bound up with my alliance with or support for this country across the world that is committing war crimes. In this case, committing genocide. And you have what call themselves the justice generation, right? Young people, black kids, Jewish kids, white Christian kids, kids who grew up in Christian Zionist households, Catholic kids, everybody growing up in the period, say, between 2014 when Mike Brown was killed in the streets of Ferguson and 2020 when George Floyd was killed on the streets of Minneapolis. And through that time, who saw police violence after police violence, black man after black man being killed, black women being shot to death, and the demonstrations that followed, the protests that followed that said, this is not okay. You know, that was a huge sea change. The summer of 2020, in the context of genocide, all those hundreds of thousands of people around the country who took to the streets wearing their masks because it was incredibly dangerous, and some of us who were kind of really worried about it because we were the old guard, who sort of stuck around the edges of the protest because you didn't want to get in the middle where people were too crowded, you were still wearing a mask, but you had to be there. The young people were the ones leading that. And they were the ones saying, I'm not going to be what my parents were growing up. I'm going to be something different. I'm part of a different generation. And for young Jewish kids, that meant saying, I'm not going to accept this notion that to be Jewish means accepting what Israel does as legitimate. That's not who I am. That's not what I'm going to be. And I got to say, for us, when I grew up at Temple Akiba, it wasn't about religion. We didn't talk about God. I don't think any of us ever believed in God. I never did. And I think most of my friends probably didn't either. But we believed in Israel. You know, we had a wonderful young youth director. He was charismatic. He was smart. He was, you know, he was fantastic. Come on in. And, you know, he talked about Israel. We talked about Israel. We didn't talk about God. We went to services sometimes, and we tried to sneak out to watch the movies at the big drive-in theater across the street, you know, right on Sepulveda. Couldn't hear the sound, but you could see the movies. That was pretty great. So, you know, it was a whole way of thinking of what it meant to be Jewish. And then after 50 years, that's just not the case anymore. So organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, which I am very proud to be part of, and I'm very grateful to for setting up for these events around the city. The young Jews have options. They can join Jewish Voice for Peace. They can join If Not Now. They can join J Street. They can join all of these alternatives to saying that being Jewish means supporting everything Israel does, not criticizing it, not asking the questions. We grew up believing Israel was a socialist country. We didn't know exactly what that meant, but we knew it was a good thing, right? We talked a lot about the socialist movement in Israel that created the kibbutz movement. It was a socialist movement, created this socialist little enclaves of collective farms. And we knew that that was created by these European Jewish settlers who had gone there and had created these great little things. And we never asked, who was there before? We never asked, whose land was it? How did they come to have that land? We didn't ask those questions. And nobody told us we should ask those questions. You know, this notion that Jews are the people of the book who revere education, there was always this little exception. Don't ask too many questions about that one, right? And we read Exodus and we're so moved. Handsome Paul Newman and, you know, I mean, really, we act, you know, really?
okay, well, oh, that's right. He was about as believable.
Yeah, okay. Well, whatever. But, you know, that was the thing. I mean, we acted out the great UN scene where the U.S. Yes. comes in to support the creation of the Jewish state and cheering. You know, the propaganda value of that, you all know that, of course, Leon Uris had been hired by various pro-Israel forces to write that
book.
I
didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a commissioned work. He's a brilliant writer. It's a fabulous book. The movie, not so much, but as I think about it now. But the book was fantastic. I read it, I think, 3 times between the ages of 10 and 11 or something like that.
Of course I did.
Right. But really, it played a huge role in how we came to understand what it meant to be Jewish in this country. So that's kind of how we come to the understanding of what does propaganda mean? How does it work? You know, and how we come to see what it's going to take to struggle against that, what it's going to take to change the position of people who grew up understanding that and taking that very seriously, as we all did. I learned some of my early organizing skills. I was being trained to be what we called a professional Jew. 590 building? Who knows what that means? Yeah, the folks of our generation. This was the Jewish center of all the Jewish and pro-Israel organizations. They all shared one big giant office building downtown called the 590 building, 590 South Vermont. I can remember it to this day. Yeah. And we went down there, we worked at Camp Hess Kramer, and we did all that stuff. And that's what it meant to be Jewish. And that's what is so much changing now, and it's so exciting that Jews are now part of the broader movement for social justice that they were always part of, except in the past there was this exception. We used to talk about PEP, Progressive Except Palestine, right? We never, like, in the civil rights movement, Jews were disproportionately represented among the white people in that movement. In the communist movement, Jews were disproportionate among the white people. It still is true. In the movement against ICE, Jews are disproportionately, maybe not everywhere, not in areas where there's not a huge Jewish community, but in areas where there are significant Jewish communities, they tend to be disproportionately represented in the social justice movements to this day. And now it's true in the Palestine movement. So it's evening out. What was this little blip in that that was missing. We're filling in the missing gap. And that's what's incredibly exciting. And one of the ways, and now I get to the second part of your hard question.
Yeah, I was
going to
say,
yeah.
Save us.
I'm saving.
From propaganda.
I'm saving. The question of international law. Because what we are seeing right now, certainly in the genocide in Gaza, but also in the U.S.-Israeli assault on Iran, and what it has happened across the region, has been so dangerously detrimental to the rule of law globally, to international law as well as to U.S. law. The U.S. laws that were violated when Trump decided to first join Israel last June to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, which have never created a nuclear bomb. The Iranians have said they never intend to. They don't have the capacity to, and there's never been anything remotely close to a nuclear bomb. But when you have two nuclear-armed nations, the United States, one of the five officially recognized nuclear weapons states, and Israel, which has never acknowledged its nuclear weapons, but is known to have them, has been since the 1980s, when they were released by an Israeli whistleblower who worked at Dimona. When I read yesterday about the bomb that hit Dimona, the small town that abuts the nuclear weapons site in the Negev, this is incredibly dangerous because they have never been inspected by the UN weapons inspectors, the IAEA. We don't know how many of them still survive. There were once maybe as much as 400 nuclear weapons. We don't know if there were that many. We think there were. Now it seems the number is lower. Now the number that usually gets tossed around is somewhere around 90. But no one knows for sure. No one knows if they have deteriorated over the years, so they are leaching radioactive material into the water, into the air. We don't know. Are they able to be used if Israel went nuts and decided to use them? We don't know. Nobody knows because they have not been inspected. The U.S. respects what the Israelis call strategic ambiguity, right, that they will neither confirm nor deny that they have nuclear weapons. When the whole world has seen the photographs, you know, the guy who worked there, who was a scientist in the nuclear weapons plant, took pictures before he fled the country, went to Australia, made them public from Australia, was then enticed into a boat in what was called a honey sting, and was arrested by the Israelis and spent 18 years in solitary confinement. He's now out of prison, but he's not allowed to leave the country. Imagine the PTSD that he faces after that. But the whole question of the attack by a nuclear weapon state on a non-nuclear weapon state, which is Iran. People in this country, I think, mostly believe that Iran is the nuclear danger in the Middle East. That it's Iranian weapons that we have to worry about. What are we going to do about Iran's nuclear weapons? Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons. Where have we heard this before?
Yeah.
Weapons of mass destruction that don't exist. Right? Sound familiar?
Yep.
And now we're going after Iran while the genocide in Gaza continues. There is no ceasefire in Gaza.
No.
There was a ceasefire declared. The attacks never stopped. What did happen, and it is important, and we must be very careful not to diminish its importance, is that the numbers of people being killed on a daily basis by Israeli bombs, Israeli tanks, has quite dramatically been reduced. That's hugely important. We are not hearing about 100, 150, 95 people killed every day, every day, every day. We are hearing about 5 or 6 or 17 people being killed every day. Two people were killed this past weekend. It's now 680 people in Gaza, I was just checking this morning from the UN, who have been killed since the so-called ceasefire was declared by Donald Trump, who declared it when there was no ceasefire, but he declared it so the world says. Even today at the UN the UN Security Council was being briefed by the guy who Trump has appointed as his coordinator of his so-called peace board, who should be ashamed of himself. He used to work for the UN as their representative to the UN, to the Israel-Palestine conflict. Mm. He said the ceasefire is holding, despite some challenges. Well, the challenges are otherwise known as murder. Mm-hmm. not just deaths. People don't just die in Gaza. They are killed. They are killed by Israeli bombs and tanks and drones, or they are killed by starvation, mainly babies and the elders, or they are killed by hyperthermia, not so much now because it's starting to be warmer. They are killed affirmatively, deliberately, and that's what we are facing. The international laws that have been violated can start with the domestic laws. They're a little quicker. They're more familiar. The sending of money and arms to a country that is at war with its neighbors, that is carrying out war crimes, is illegal under at least 5 separate U.S. laws. The Arms Export Control Act, there's a host of them. And they all have slightly different versions of what makes it illegal, right? But everything that Israel is doing in Gaza is all illegal. And what we now know from the resignation of the State Department people who left in protest of the genocide is that Israel, the U.S. not only made different choices for accountability for Israel versus every other country in the world about who can get U.S. military aid, who can get U.S. arms, who can buy U.S. planes, U.S. bombs, etc. It had a separate office who did only the Israel assessments. And they never once said no. Their job was to approve everything Israel asked for. And they did it, which we all knew sort of happened. I didn't know, at least, that they actually had a separate office that was in the context of people who work at the State Department. They knew that, right? So those violations are huge. Then we get to the question of Congress, right? When we talk about Iran, when we talk about going to war against Iran last June and again just last month, a war that is continuing now, that is destabilizing the entire world and threatening a global war as well as a regional war. And we all remember the words of the great scientist Albert Einstein, who said, "I don't know what World War IV is going to look like, what World War III is going to look like, but I can tell you what World War IV is going to be fought with: sticks and stones." It's a sobering reality, but it is very real, and we ignore that advice at our peril. So when we talk about international law, what are we talking about? The first thing, it goes back to the trials that happened in Nuremberg following the Holocaust that created the whole body of law that we know as international humanitarian law, which is the laws of war, the Geneva Conventions, all that stuff. That was all created in the context of the Holocaust on the basis of never again, right? And what they said in Nuremberg was that the supreme international crime, that was the phrase, the supreme international crime, is the crime of aggression, going to war illegally. So before you get to specific war crimes, collective punishment, targeting civilians, all the stuff that, you know, is pretty familiar to people, gets violated all the time. Not only Israel is hardly the only one that violates those. There's something called the crime of aggression, which means going to war without the two ways, the only two ways that a war can be legal, according to the UN Charter. The UN Charter is kind of the fundamental component of international law, right? And it says no nation has the right to go to war against another nation. Period, full stop. Article 2 of the UN Charter. You get to Article 51, and it says, nothing in this charter should deny the right of a nation to self-defense if, the first condition, if an armed attack occurs, until the second condition, until the Security Council can meet to decide collectively what should be done about that threat to international peace and security. So it's a very tenuous, cautious authorization, and it's very narrow. It's only until you can actually convene everybody. And these days, you can convene everybody by Zoom in a minute, which, you know, they didn't really know that then, but okay. The second way that a war can be legal is if the Security Council itself authorizes such a war. Well, neither of those two things happened in this case. There was no armed attack by Iran against the United States. Nobody is claiming there was. And the Security Council was never even asked, let alone agreed, to authorize a military attack the way they did, the way they were forced to and bribed to and punished to in 1991 under the first George Bush for the first war against Iraq, which was, ironically enough, as horrific as it was legal under international law because the Security Council had authorized it. We fought against that for 8 months. The council stood defiant of the U.S. pressure, and then they collapsed. That was the collapse of the U.N. at that point. This time around, there was no effort to do that. There was not even the pretense. And the reason that the attack on international law, on the rule of law, and of international law in general right now is so serious is that at least when George Bush II went to war without authorization, because, you know, they tried and tried and they failed, and then they went to war anyway, and then eventually the UN collapsed and said it was okay. But when they went to war, there was no authorization. It was thoroughly illegal. But at least they had acknowledged that there was a requirement. They did spend some months trying to get permission from the Security Council to go to war.
In 2003.
In 2003. But they failed. So it was illegal. But they had admitted that there was a law that prohibited it. Right? This time around, Trump says, the only thing constricting my power is my own moral judgment.
Yeah.
He's got the moral judgment of a flea. And this is what we're left with? This is not about international law. Somehow we are immune from being held accountable.
Yep.
And this is why what South Africa did in bringing charges against Israel for violating the Genocide Convention to the International Court of Justice in The Hague is so incredibly important. It's hugely...
Thank you.
I know.
Exactly. It's hugely important in terms of holding Israel accountable for this enormous crime. And I'll speak to the convention in a minute. But it's also important for another reason, which is that it legitimizes the understanding that institutions like the International Court of Justice do not belong only to the white colonial countries. Mm-hmm. Right? It was always understood that even though it says every country has the right, blah, 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 that in the real world, it's North America, it's Europe, it's Australia and New Zealand, it's apartheid South Africa. Those are the countries, basically, who get access to the International Court of Justice. Maybe there would be a situation where Ecuador and Peru would go to the court to resolve a border dispute. Okay, against each other. But the idea that a poor African country, a black majority country that is now a rainbow nation, could take a powerful friend of the United States to court in The Hague, this was not on anybody's agenda. And South Africa broke the mold and said, yes, we can. Yes, we can. That is our obligation after fighting against apartheid ourselves. We know what apartheid looks like, and we know what it leads to. So that has been a hugely important part of defending international law as a concept, right? But the big weakness of international law, it's not the laws, actually. It's the lack of enforcement of the laws. And that's a huge problem. Because, like the General Assembly, the International Court of Justice, which, unlike the Assembly, its laws supposedly are binding. The General Assembly, they say, is not binding. It's advisory. Mm-hmm. It advises countries what they should do. But it doesn't have any enforcement. The ICJ is supposed to be enforceable. But it doesn't have an army. It's like what they say about the Pope. How many armies does the Pope have? You know. Well, the Pope has a moral credibility. Not all Catholics see it the same way, you understand. But has a moral credibility that's really important in the world. The ICJ has that, too. They also, like the Pope, don't have an army. They don't have a police force. They don't have a process server to like go serve somebody with a subpoena and some dictator, you know, you are hereby ordered to appear. They don't have even that, right? So what happens? We in our social movements have to be the enforcers of international law. That's the solution. And we know that it works because we've seen it work. In the 1980s, we had a very similar situation with South Africa. Apartheid South Africa is ruling the black majority with impunity, with incredible levels of repression, right? And over again, different countries are going to the Security Council and saying, we need a resolution to impose sanctions against apartheid South Africa, to end apartheid. We need an arms embargo. We need trade sanctions. We need banking sanctions. We need whatever. And the U.S. would say, oh, don't be ridiculous. We're vetoing it. Say, okay, then we go to the General Assembly. And the Assembly passes these resolutions with long lists, menus of all these things that need to be done by individual member states. And they pass them with enormous majorities. And the U.S. says, well, we don't care. They're not enforceable. So we're going to ignore it. But people in all those other countries didn't ignore it. They went and pressured their own governments saying, look, we know this isn't enforceable, but this is what international law requires. We don't want to be an outlier state. We want to be living in a country that abides by international law. So we're demanding that you, our president, our king, our parliament, our whatever, start abiding by this list of things that the General Assembly said we should do. We should have an arms embargo. We should be imposing banking sanctions. We should impose trade sanctions. You know, all that different stuff. And eventually, they all started giving in to those powerful movements. And enough of them did, including U.S. allies, that eventually, under Ronald Reagan, of all people, thank you, Hollywood, sorry, you know, to say, okay, I give in. We'll allow the anti-apartheid movement in this country to have its victory in Congress and call for sanctions. Of course, they didn't say that's okay. They vetoed the first time around. Reagan vetoed it. But there were enough votes in the Congress to override the veto. And wow. Finally, the U.S. passed sanctions against apartheid South Africa. And that played a huge role in setting the stage for what the people of South Africa were finally able to do on their own, which was to overthrow apartheid, right? We need to do the same thing. Our friends around the world are trying. We need to be working with them. You know, at least two countries that I know of in Europe, both the UK and Italy, have big protests coming up this Saturday on our No Kings Day. In Italy, they're calling for no kings, no militarism, to stop the European militarization of NATO. In the UK, they're not saying no king, I guess. But they're saying some version of it. And they were very glad to know that we were doing the same thing.
Wow.
So this whole question of what do we do because there's no possibility of the UN working. I know there's campaigns going on that we need the Uniting for Peace precedent at the UN. Well, the resolution that was passed by the General Assembly in September of 2024, a year and a half ago, was based on those two incredible decisions of the International Court of Justice, which said in one of them was the preliminary decision on the genocide case. They haven't made final ruling on that case, but they said this is plausibly genocidal. And as a result of that plausible assessment, we are ordering Israel to do six things, the first of which was stop killing people in Gaza. They didn't use the term ceasefire, so a lot of people were disappointed, but they did, in this roundabout way, say that they had to stop carrying out any of the five violent acts listed in the Genocide Convention, the first of which is killing people. So it was pretty clear. And then there's some other stuff they're supposed to do. The Israelis, of course, said, no, it's not binding. We're going to ignore you. But they then turned that order over to the General Assembly and said, you deal with it. They also wrote an advisory opinion around the same time that was based on a much earlier request by the General Assembly to the court to rule on the legality or illegality of Israel's whole process of occupation. And they made an incredible ruling, which nobody expected. We all thought there would be some good pieces in it, but nobody thought, I think, maybe somebody with more prescient abilities than I have, but I don't know anybody who thought it was going to be this good. They ruled that the entire process of occupation is illegal, that the settlement building is completely illegal, that all settlers from the 67 territories had to be evacuated by last December, right? Now, we all know those things didn't happen, but they are now part of international law, and they never were before. So that process, those two orders by the court, One, the advisory opinion on the whole occupation. The other, the specific stuff around genocide, were combined into this incredible resolution of the General Assembly, taken under the Uniting for Peace precedent, that says that when the Security Council is paralyzed because of the veto, the General Assembly can take up stuff that ordinarily can only be addressed by the Council. In this case, the occupation, the genocide, the threat to international peace and security. And they passed that resolution 164 to, I think it was 14. Mm. It was amazing. It was the overwhelming majority of the whole world who said this. So then the question is, how do we enforce it? And the answer is the way we did in the 1980s around South Africa. The differences and the challenge to us all is that South Africans, as oppressed as they were under apartheid, they were not facing genocide. They were not being killed on a daily basis. It was a very different situation. It took 15 years for that process to work through the UN and the courts and all of that. We don't have 15 years. The Palestinians are already being erased from history, expelled from their own land. Ethnic cleansing is underway on a daily basis. The annexation, the de facto annexation of the UN, of the West Bank, while the U.S. says, they're not annexing territory, we wouldn't allow that. Well, good luck with that, because they're already doing it, just not using the word. Mm-hmm. So this is the challenge that we faced. And on top of that, this is now linked directly, the genocide in Gaza led directly to the impunity that the U.S. and Israel feel in attacking Iran. Mm-hmm. We got away with it there.
Yeah.
Israel said we got away with it there, and now we're going after South Lebanon. We're occupying that. Over 1,000 people have been killed in South Lebanon by Israeli bombs since the so-called ceasefire. Right? I mean, this is, we don't hear about this on a daily basis, but this is ongoing with our money. Mm-hmm. The $1 trillion military budget this year is paying for all this. And we hear, well, there's no money, of course, for school, for healthcare, for jobs, for childcare, for any of these things. Why? Because we're spending $1 trillion on the military. So we have a lot of work to do.
Woo. Thank you, Phyllis.
I'm sure that a lot of you are forming questions in your own mind, and I'll take hands. I'm going to wrangle the Q&A. So, are you, Esti? I hand it to you.
I'm going to actually do this. Can I? Do you guys mind if I ask one quick question?
Go for it.
Can you address not the other things that once they declared that the entire West Bank settler colonial project is illegal? Can you talk about the other things that affect us, like U.S. companies?
Yeah. This is huge. One of the things that's so extraordinary about the Genocide Convention, the Apartheid Convention, and very few other things in international law, the signatories and parties to those conventions have obligations that go beyond the obligations against the perpetrator, right? The conventions are called, it's the International Convention Against, International Convention for the Prevention and Suppression of the Crime of Genocide, and the International Convention for the Prevention and Suppression of the Crime of Apartheid, right? And in there, of course, the starting point is all the stuff about what Israel needs, in this case, what Israel needs to do to stop its apartheid policies, to stop its occupation. It's a whole long list of things. Evacuate the settlers, all those things. But then it says, what does the General Assembly need to do? What does the United Nations need to do? And it's a series of things that the UN is being told by the court are now your obligations, which includes non-recognition of anything Israel tries to do that involves speaking on behalf of the occupied territories. Then it gets, and there's a bunch of others, then it gets to what are the obligations of individual member states. So that includes diplomatic stuff, You do not have an embassy in occupied territory, something that the U.S. has just moved its embassy to Jerusalem to do, deliberately by Trump in his first term, in his first year in office, and left there by Joe Biden, and now embraced again, of course, by Trump, in violation of all kinds of international laws. It also says preventing entities in your country from engaging in commerce, in trade, in arms shipments, and a whole host of other things with Israel if there is any connection to the occupied Palestinian territory. Now, when it comes to weapons, as we know, Israel has used every single thing in its arsenal, including the 5,000-pound so-called bunker buster bombs that we provide them with, which the U.S., until last week in Iran, had never used in combat. Jeez. It produced them, never used them, never sold them to anybody except Israel, and Israel used them for the last 2 years against Gaza. These are bombs that, one of which, can destroy a city block, demolish high-rise buildings across a city block, and kill every living thing within them. So that when we've seen what Gaza now looks like, as it's 70 million tons of rubble, that rubble was largely created by these bunker buster bombs, many of them the 5,000 pound bombs that we provide. That is in complete violation of international law. So both the companies that are producing those bombs, the shipping companies, Maersk and the others that are shipping these things around the world, the airlines that are shipping the bombs, the Congress that is approving the bombs, not to mention the White House that is offering the bombs, are all guilty of war crimes and probably crimes against humanity in this context. So the question of accountability comes right back to us, right? And our obligation as the enforcers of international law.
So now Mimi, you guys are going to raise your hand for a question. Mimi's going to pick. I'm just going to run around with the microphone. So
I get to pick. Okay. you know, I just wanted to say this. When I see signs, as we will on Saturday at the No Kings March, and I've often seen, you know, no war crimes, and I often think, oh, that's very harsh. Most people don't understand what you mean. And I think it's true. It's like no kings, I get that. No war crimes, I kind of get that. But it's the law. That's what I love about listening to Phyllis. I have to be reminded that there are laws, and to say no war crimes is simply to say, you know, hey, support your local police. Whatever, there's a whole mindset that Americans have, again, indoctrination.
Yeah, American exceptionalism.
American exceptionalism. We're not committing war crimes. We obey the law. I know we feel that way much less now because of this administration. For the second time, it's very clear they don't care about laws. And we are all vulnerable because of that, because no one is protected. But thank you, Phyllis. I just wanted to say that. I'm going to think.
But
say
can,
no
can
war
I just
crimes.
Say one aspect of that?
The other ones.
Okay, sorry.
I'm sorry.
Which goes to the bipartisan nature of all this, which I think is really important. This is not a partisan issue. I work at an institute, a 501c3, for those of you who know what that means, a nonprofit. We don't take positions on either candidates or parties or any of that. We kind of criticize all of them. That makes it easy. But some of these things, most of these things, have a very bipartisan, bitter history, including the diminishing acceptance of the idea that the United States is bound by the same international laws as the rest of the world. The notion, we've been hearing a lot in the last few years, during the first Trump term, throughout the Biden term, and now about the international law, what do they call it? The international law something order. The international rules-based order, that's it. This is the new term. I came into a conference I was speaking at a bit late a few months ago, and there was a panel that I was listening to before mine that were a bunch of people that I knew well that, you know, sort of share my politics and whatever, and each of them was talking about the rules-based order, and I'm like, why are you people accepting this? This whole thing was designed to undermine the fact that international law exists. It's written down. It's what they call black letter law. you know, that's like in a book, gets violated all the time, but you can't say you don't know what it is.
Uh-huh.
The rules-based order is whatever any powerful person in the White House or in Congress or in whatever says it is. It doesn't exist. It's how you start undermining the actual international law, whether it's the Geneva Convention, the Vienna Convention. You know, there's all these conventions. Most of them are kind of gibberish when you read them, frankly. They're designed to be not understood by people who are not experts. But a few of them, like the Genocide Convention, like the Apartheid Convention, are really very simple. They're written in a very simple way, and they are to be enforced.